I think that we look at the highlight reels that people present and we expect that it should be as easy as what it looks like for them. But it wasn't easy for them either. We just don't know the background. And so I think it can be really, really discouraging when you want an answer. You know, you're young, you want to know what to pursue. You want a quick answer. You want a linear path and you want to be like, okay, this is it. I know exactly where I'm going. I know exactly what I want to do. Now it's just a matter of figuring out the path to get there. And I think that that's a little bit more of a myth than I realized when I was an undergrad.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Under Oath, a podcast brought to you and hosted by the organization Women Pursuing Law. I'm Hani Siddiqui, WPL's president.
And I'm Zara Kabir, WPL's vice president. Under Oath will aim to shed light on different career paths within law, give you the chance to hear from noted speakers, and show the industry from the POV of a woman.
Under Oath will also serve as a platform dedicated to empowering women and non-binary conforming individuals in the law industry. So if that aligns with your ideas, be sure to subscribe to our podcast.
On that note, be sure to follow us on our Instagram at UTDWPL and our LinkedIn at UTD Women Pursuing Law. And without further ado, let's get right into this episode.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Under Oath. I'm Kavya, and I'll be your host for our second discussion into the world of corporate law. Today, I'm joined by Aisha Noor, a current associate attorney at Kirkland & Ellis. Aisha is an alumnus of the University of Texas at Dallas, shout out to UTD, and the University of Chicago Law School. Aisha, would you like to give a brief introduction about yourself?
Sure. Hi, I'm super excited to be here. My name is Aisha Noor. I am a brown girl who's born and raised in Dallas, Texas. Came up through UTD, went to law school at UChicago, and had, you know, never wanted to be a lawyer. So here we are. Pleasant surprise. I love it. But definitely, you know, if you had asked Aisha 10 years ago where she thought she would be, it would not be speaking to a podcast that is all about getting women into law. But here we are. It's my favorite thing to do is talking to prospective lawyers and getting to show you guys like what it's really like to get to this point, but also when you're here, because I think there's a very varnished and highlight reel version of law that people see.
I love that. I really do. I want to say it's really cool to talk to you as a graduate of UTD and as a brown girl. I get that. I know a lot of our listeners have aspirations similar to your career path, and I hope that they can use you as an inspiration to follow their dreams. And like you said, not just get the highlight reel of law. I also want to thank you for taking the time to join us today. I know the life of a lawyer is really hectic, and we greatly appreciate you coming on here and sharing some insight into your world. Speaking of UTD, I saw on your LinkedIn profile that you actually graduated with a bachelor's in political science and with a master's in public affairs. Would you mind talking a bit about how these degrees helped shape your transition into law school, and would you recommend taking these majors?
Sure. I think I am the worst person to ask this question to, I'll just be honest. I think the coolest thing about law is that there isn't really a pre-law track per se. There isn't Chem 1, Chem 2, organic chemistry, biology. You don't have to follow a specific path to get to law school. And I think what that means is it opens up the opportunities for students to become more well-rounded, but to also pursue what they're interested in. I didn't do my political science degree with an eye towards being a lawyer. My dad had told me since I was a little kid, he was like, you're going to be a lawyer. And anytime I tell that story, people are like, oh, is it because you were super argumentative? I was like, no, I'm actually like a very non-confrontational. I'd like to think I'm chill, but I'm extremely type A, like a lot of lawyers are. But I was just a non-confrontational person, but I have a very analytical approach to basically everything. And I think my dad saw that and he was like, I think this would be a good path for her. And of course, me being rebellious kid that I thought I was like, Dad, there's no way. So I went to UTD and I looked around, and my freshman year, I talked to my mom, I talked to my advisors, I talked to mentors, and the advice that I kept getting was do what you're interested in. If you're going to study something for 4 years, make sure you don't hate every minute of it. And my freshman year, I kind of narrowed it down to like 3 degrees that I was really interested in. I was like, okay, I like political science, I like psychology. And back then at UTD, they had a major called Emerging Media and Communications, which was a branch of the ATEC school, Arts and Technology. Anyways, it was like a Web 2.0 communications degree. And I was like, that sounds really interesting. super, you know, on the cusp of something new. I want to explore that. And I spent my first year in college really exploring. I had kind of a unique path to college in that I had done a little bit of dual credit, and I also started college when I was 15. And so I kind of had this moment where I was like, I got time. I'm going to just like take it easy. I'm going to explore, and I'm going to make sure that like I don't feel pressured to walk down a path that I might not enjoy. So I spent that first year exploring. I ended up taking some really cool poli sci classes with some professors that I'm still in touch with. And I was like, okay, this is really interesting. I think I could like read about this and write essays about this and take tests about this for 4 years. And that was really my only perspective. I was like, I just want to do something that I will enjoy, that I like studying. And that's what I did. So I pursued my bachelor's degree in political science. And I got towards the end of my degree, and I was like, I really don't know what I want to do with my future. I know my dad keeps saying law school. I'm going to do everything I can to avoid that path, and kind of found my way to law school. And I'm sure we can touch on that a little bit later. But the master's degree and the bachelor's degree were really things that I enjoyed, things that I wanted to do, things that I was interested in. And I think that that's, again, the beauty of law schools. You don't really have to take classes that are going to prepare you, because nothing's going to prepare you for law school. It's just not. The LSAT might prepare you for law school better than your undergraduate did. And I think that for me, I was grateful that I didn't just do poli sci because I thought it was the right degree for a pre-law track. Because I got to law school and I thought I would be totally prepared based on that poli sci and public affairs background, and I just wasn't. I knew how to read a lot and I knew how to write, and maybe those are skills that I needed, but writing in law school is so different from writing in undergrad that it didn't make a difference compared to my friends who were electrical engineers, who had history backgrounds or art backgrounds. So I think that in undergrad, and this is like a thing that I'm very passionate about, I think it's important to just do what you enjoy and study things that you like, because the biggest and most important part of undergrad is learning how you study best, not what you're studying, just how, because those are the skills that you're going to need in law school. It's not what you were studying. It's the methods that you develop to get yourself through material, to get yourself prepped for tests, and to get yourself through those essays. Those are the skills that matter, and how you build the skills that you might need for law school that might help. Didn't help me. I wasn't very good at law school. But yeah, I don't think there's any particular major, and I really encourage all of my mentees to take things that they're interested in, that they care about, because there aren't a lot of paths where you can do that. And law school is one of the lucky few. So I really encourage people to take advantage of that.
And going off on what you said, you were trying to avoid the path to going to law because of what your dad said. What made you finally settle on that?
I think it was a couple of things. So I, you know, the poli sci track is very like pre-law focused. I got to know a lot of professors in the pre-law space. And I think importantly, I had a couple of internships that were really key for me. So one was with the Innocence Project of Texas. So a lot of law schools have what they call clinics, where you work with like real legal aid organizations as a law student, and you provide legal services under, you know, the supervision of real lawyers and with guidance from those organizations. But you're getting to do like real law things. And UTD at the time, under the guidance of Dr. Champagne, who's like one of my best mentors, it's so sad that he retired, but he brought a clinic to UT Dallas. And it was the only undergraduate like law legal clinic of its type in the state. And so we were the only undergrads in the state who had the opportunity to be doing like real law things. And so I was immediately like, okay, this is really interesting to me. The Innocence Project, what they do is they, you know, they get letters and they get inquiries from people who are incarcerated all the time saying, hey, we are innocent of the crimes that we have been put away for. Please help me get out of prison. And what the Innocence Project does is it first, you know, vets those claims. And then if they find someone who has, you know, a really cognizable claim of innocence, something that they can argue for in court, then they will go and try to get that person out of prison. And I, you know, at that time was learning more about racial justice. It's early days, like people were not woke. I feel very old, but like people were not like woke, so to speak, back then. But I was starting to get a sense of racial justice and criminal justice reform. And I was like, hey, this is something I care about. This is a material and tangible way that I can help someone. And like, this could be really interesting. So I got involved in that clinic. And what we did in that clinic at UTD was we were kind of the first line of defense. So the Innocence Project of Texas would take someone that they thought had like a decent argument in the materials that they sent them. And then we would go through all of the police reports, all of the trial transcripts, all of the exhibits, all of the evidence at trial. And we would read like thousands upon thousands upon thousands of pages of material. And we would synthesize those into a presentation to the rest of our class. We were in like, I think it was like a class of 20. We were like five groups of four. So we had five cases going on at any time. So your pod would go through the case, would build the timeline, would figure out what evidence was used in court, whether it was admissible, whether it wasn't, was the jury selected correctly, was there racial bias in how the jury was selected, were all the black jurors somehow thrown out? And, you know, you'd look for things like that, and then you'd put together a presentation and you'd present it to the class. You'd be like, here are the facts of the case. We think this person has or does not have a cognizable claim of innocence. And we would host a discussion among the class for ideas on how to get this person's case to a position where the Innocence Project could argue it. And it was really interesting. And I think it was one of those moments where I was like, this is real material good that I'm doing. And this is something that I think is really important. The other thing that the Innocence Project taught me was that there was just no way I could do that for the rest of my life. I was like, I really like this, but I can't sleep at night. I literally cannot sleep at night. I'm having trouble compartmentalizing the pain and the suffering that I'm seeing, and I'm not being able to function. And I think that that was a really interesting moment for me where I saw something that I really cared about and then realized that it would probably personally not be something that I could live with. It was something that I was just not able to do the necessary compartmentalizing that a lot of people have to do to like live their lives normally while serving these really important causes. And so that was a moment where I was like, I really like this. I think I will die. Like, I don't think I can do it. And so I kept working with the Innocence Project for like 3 years into my master's, you know, ended up doing my thesis on wrongful convictions in Texas. It was something that I just really cared about. In the back of my mind, I was like, I don't see a future for myself here. This is something I care a lot about, but I don't know that I can like survive this. And so I kind of like put that in the back of my mind, but I knew that like I enjoyed it. And then something else happened that I think was the other piece, and it was the Archer Fellowship. I don't know how many folks or if you guys are aware of the Archer Fellowship, but it is a fellowship that was started by Congressman Bill Archer, former Congressman Bill Archer. And it basically is set up for students from across the UT systems, UT Austin, UT Tyler, UT Dallas, et cetera, to go to DC and do stuff. And it's really cool that it is so open-ended because you essentially, once you are awarded the fellowship, you can go out and you can get an internship wherever you want. And you can kind of pursue your interests. So I had friends who were interested in going into the medical field and who were like, well, I really am interested in political science and how can I meld the two? And they got internships at the NHS. Or they got, you know, you can really craft that fellowship into what you're interested in. So I applied for a lot of internships, got a couple of like cool big name marquee things, UN, White House, etc. But then I got an offer from the Supreme Court. And I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. They had a really, really tiny intern program. And I was given an offer in the curator's office. And the curator of the Supreme Court, what they do is they basically curate, as the name would suggest, the history of the court. And they also build materials and programs to educate average people about the court. Because I think that if there was a branch of government that's somewhat shrouded in mystery, definitely the Supreme Court. So they kind of work to demystify it. And I was like, ah, this is cool. Like, I don't know if I want to do law. Maybe I'm pigeonholing myself. Also, there's the White House. It was the Obama White House back then. So like, no complaints. And I think that when I was considering it, the court granted cert. So they granted cert to the first Obamacare case. And so they basically said, we're going to hear this case and we're going to render a ruling on it. And I was like, oh, okay, got to be there. Definitely want to be there. That's going to be really cool. That's going to be like a marquee case of our generation. And I was like, I just want to be a fly on the wall. And so I went to the Supreme Court, and it was a very interesting experience to be a fly on the wall in that building, to be like in the cafeteria and have like Ruth Bader Ginsburg getting her fruit cup a couple like feet down and trying not to like stare or pass out. But like, you know, you're seeing these people who have their titans in the legal fields, and they have rendered decisions that have impacted the lives of everyone, you know, of you. And it was very cool to be a fly on the wall in that building. You know, having the opportunity to like sit in the side of the court during really important cases like the Obamacare case. There were a couple of other cases as well that I remember sitting through and being like, first of all, could never do this. Would never want to do this. Would never want to be involved in this. But like really cool. And I think that started to be my experience with law, was like, I think this is cool. I just hate it. I hate the like mechanical aspect of what I'm doing. And I can't figure out why, because I'm interested in all of these things. But like the day-to-day, either in the case of the Innocence Project, it was making me, you know, lose any sense of mental wellness that I had because I was so heavy. Or in the case of, you know, listening to appellate advocacy at the highest level. And I was just like, oh my God, I'm so, like, I don't think I could craft these arguments. I don't think I could do all of the legal research required to like present a compelling case. And I was just like, man, all of this is so interesting to me, but I don't think I would enjoy doing it myself. And I think that that was an interesting moment for me, because I'd always thought I was going to be a public interest lawyer. All of my interests had kind of pushed towards that. I had been doing a lot of, you know, research, not just about wrongful conviction, but about environmental racism, about the ways that laws and the ways that minorities and people of color are not just disadvantaged by the amount of funding for schools, but the fact that they're living next to landfills that would never be placed in rich neighborhoods, and the effect that that type of pollution has on health outcomes, has on people's mental health. Lead poisoning and its effect on people's cognitive abilities. And I was learning about all of this, and I was like, I'm definitely going to be a public interest lawyer. Obviously, this is what I care about. These are the things that I could go on and on and on about. And then I was like, I don't like the practical aspect of what would need to be done. It's like being a public interest lawyer. And that was a really scary moment. And I think that what I eventually realized was I don't have to be a lawyer to do those things. And I think that's what a lot of people don't realize is I know so many mentees, so many friends, so many young people in college who have these things that they care about. And they're like, well, of course I have to go to law school to pursue these. And I just don't think you do. I think that you could save yourself a lot of debt. I think you could save yourself a lot of time, a lot of pain, and you can still affect change at those levels. And I had to really grapple with that as I was trying to figure out my next step. So I bought myself some time and I did that master's degree. And I was like, okay, public affairs, I can start to think about, you know, the bureaucratic aspect of government and how you can affect change from that route. And for me, as you guys can probably tell, the path of law school is very much like a process of elimination, where I was like, okay, this is kind of nice. I worked at a chamber of commerce. I like did a lot of political advocacy, and I was like, this is cool. I don't think I want to do this either. And I think that like, I remember getting really disillusioned and disappointed and kind of scared that I would never find what I was interested in. And I was finally like, okay, let's get back to like super, super, super basics. What are you good at? What do you like? And what do you think will like get you to the point where you have enough information to make your next step? And that was when I kind of got back to, okay, I'm an analytical person. I like to get as much information as I can about a situation and then make judgment calls and try to determine the best strategy for overcoming whatever challenge there is. And I was like, you know what? I basically want to be a professional problem solver. That's what I want to do. And I think that probably the fact that I'm a little too empathetic means that I can't do it for people. That maybe I need to be a professional problem solver for business. And maybe that's the route I want to travel. And I realized that to pursue that further, I needed to go to law school, because you can affect change, social change, without going to law school. And I firmly believe this. But you can't be a corporate attorney without a JD. And I was like, okay, we're just going to give this one a shot. So I ended up going to law school and realizing that all the things that I care about, all the things that I'm really interested in, are things that I get to do pro bono throughout the year. I just submitted 3 expungements to the Harris County District Court. Expungements are basically where someone has something on their record, either the statute of limitations has passed, or they fall under certain statutory, you know, requirements that make them eligible to have that offense expunged from their record, basically erased, and so the employers can't see it, so that the landlords at their apartments can't see it. And it can have a really great impact on their lives, because you suddenly don't have a felony on your record, or you suddenly don't have a couple misdemeanors on your record. So I do a lot of work with expungements. I do a lot of work with people seeking asylum and immigrants. I do a lot of work with racial justice. And I also, and this is not pro bono work, but it's something that I think is really important, is I try to find ways to broaden the pipeline of people who are coming to law. Because the fact of the matter is, there's not a lot of people who look like me. There's not a lot of people who don't fit the mold of being like a white man, a cis, het, white man. And I think that one of the most important things for me in terms of what I care about and increasing access is broadening the pipeline, talking to people who are in high school, talking to people who are in undergrad, talking to law students, and trying to give them the keys to end up where I have and go further than I will ever go. I think what I realized is, and this is somewhat dark, is that your job does not have to be your calling. Your job can be a means to keeping you supported and keeping you happy and keeping you interested and keeping you challenged, but you can pursue the things that you care about and that you're passionate about in addition to your job. And I think that, and that became very important because I'm doing something I really enjoy and that I'm challenged by every day, but I also get to take, 5 to 10 hours a week and delve into things that I really care about, but that would rip my heart apart if I spent 40, 60, 70, 100 hours a week on them alone. And hats off to the people who do it full time. I wish I was strong enough. I wish I had the capacity and the ability to compartmentalize, like so many people, so many friends that I have who are criminal defense attorneys or prosecutors or who work for legal aid organizations. But I realized that I had to work with my weaknesses, and I had to find the path that would work best for me as a person, but where I could also pursue things that I was passionate about.
Right. And I think you said that so beautifully. And I think right now I see that a lot of people think that their experiences that they have in life need to perfectly align with what they want to do. But like you said, your experiences helped you narrow down and figure out, this is not what I want to do. I love it, but it's not, I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it for the rest of my life. And I think those experiences are just as important, if not more important, than figuring out, okay, this is exactly what I want to do.
Totally. And that's what I was talking about when I was talking about the highlight reel thing, where I could, anyone could come on here and be like, I love my job, here's how I got here. But there's so much that goes into getting where you are. I mean, I was where you were sitting 10, 12 years ago. And I remember thinking like, oh, this should be easy, right? Everyone finds the thing that they want to do very easily. Like, why is this taking me a long time? And I think people just don't talk about it enough. And that's why it's important to me to be really open about that, because I think that we look at the highlight reels that people present and we expect that it should be as easy as what it looks like for them. But it wasn't easy for them either. We just don't know the background. And so, I think it can be really, really discouraging when you want an answer. You're young, you want to know what to pursue, you want a quick answer, you want a linear path, and you want to be like, okay, this is it. I know exactly where I'm going. I know exactly what I want to do. Now it's just a matter of figuring out the path to get there. And I think that that's a little bit more of a myth than I realized when I was an undergrad.
Well, now transitioning from your college experiences, you currently work as an associate attorney at Kirkland & Ellis. Can you talk a little bit about the process of choosing a law firm fresh out of law school, as well as your experience working at such a large firm?
I think the hardest decision to make in law school is deciding whether you want to be a litigation attorney or a transactional attorney. And then there are a couple of specialties, right? Like IP law and things like that. But I think the hardest thing to figure out is what path you want to go. I was really lucky. I had ruled out basically all the litigation stuff before I even went to law school. And so I knew pretty quickly that I wanted to focus on the transactional side of things. And the transactional side of things is deal work. You make deals, you do deals, you negotiate deals, you paper deals. And, you know, whether it's through a merger, whether it's through an acquisition, whether it's through a big financing, whether it's through a company going public, you do things. And my day-to-day is based more in negotiation than it is in adversarial conflict, right? Litigation is meant to keep the adversarial system working. And the adversarial system is a hallmark and very important aspect of our legal world. I don't do that. I negotiate. And I think that is a little bit different. I knew in law school, like I said, that I wanted to be a transactional attorney, and it was a matter of narrowing down where. And it was also a matter of narrowing down what kind of transactional attorney I wanted to be. And I think that if you go to a good enough law school, and we can talk more about, you know, the path to law school, but I think if you go to a good enough law school, you have law firms that are knocking on your door as opposed to the other way around. And so I had the opportunity to go to mixers, go to events, go to networking things with all kinds of law firms. And what I realized was a couple of things. One, they all say the same thing. They're all collegial. They are all teamwork oriented. They all care about training, and they all value their associates. All those things might be true. But I think that it becomes very important to talk to people about their day-to-day experience at a firm. And the one thing that I advise people to do, especially while you're interviewing and things like that, is I essentially, instead of building, you know, instead of asking questions in an interview based on the conversation, and I would like try to ask some of those, I would go into any interview with the same question. And I would ask the same question every single time I met with a different firm, and every time I met with a different attorney at the same firm. And the idea for me was, I'm going to ask the same question so that I have a data set of answers to compare against each other. If you're not asking the same question, you're never going to build a data set that you can reliably look at and start to differentiate firms based on. And so I asked the same questions to all the firms that I spoke with. And I think that was a helpful way for me to start narrowing down what was important to me and where I wanted to work. But I also think the thing that is comforting about the fact that a lot of these firms are really the same is the fact that as a junior attorney, all you're really looking for is training. All you're looking for is the repetition and the practice that you get in doing a deal. And where you work doesn't matter as much as you would think it does. And I know that's different from what I was told in law school, but looking back now, 4 years into my career, I realized that I could have gone anywhere and I would have probably gotten similar training. And I started at a firm that wasn't Kirkland & Ellis. I lateraled to Kirkland & Ellis. I started another firm. It's somewhat smaller, still big law. But I started in a really small Dallas office. And I got the best training I could have asked for. And it was an office that, you know, it wasn't as prestigious as Kirkland. It wasn't, you know, it didn't have the same resources that we do at a firm like Kirkland, but I got better training than I see any of our juniors getting at Kirkland. And I, because of that, was able to pass that along. Now on my deal teams, you know, I make sure that I have, you know, we'll have calls, whether it's daily, whether it's every other day, to kind of check in. And I'll make sure that at the end of those calls, I keep the first years back and the second years back if necessary. And I'm like, okay, what weird questions do you guys have? What came up that you're confused about? What can I explain? Is there any context that I can offer for the things that are kind of going on around you at the speed of light that is really hard to understand because law school just doesn't prepare you for deal work. And I think that I learned the importance of training being at a firm that was a little bit less prestigious. And I went to another firm and I realized that that was something that kind of lacked at a place that had such a volume of deals constantly. Everyone's working really hard around the clock all the time, and you get amazing repetitions. But if you never start to understand the context of what you're doing and why you're doing it, if you don't find people who will train you, if you don't find ways to train yourself, a lot of those repetitions start to look very empty because you're not internalizing what's happening and why it's important. And, you know, I went to a smaller firm and I was running my own deals as a second year. And then I brought that experience to Kirkland and I'm running my own deals as a third year and a fourth year. And there are partners who are surprised by that. And I'm like, it's because I got different training than your first years are getting. And I'm trying to train your first years so they can do what I did as a second year. But like, there are only so many people who are setting time aside. So I think that trying to really understand the pace of the work and trying to also understand if you're going to get good training from the partners, not from the associates, from the partners, is the most important part of finding a good law firm. But I think that's really hard to see from the surface sometimes. And I think that law school's focus on prestige really blinds people to finding places that are going to get them good training. I'm not saying go to a second tier law firm. If you have the opportunity to do big law, do big law. It's exactly what I did. But I went to a shop where I was like, you know, this is not the same level of prestige that I would have wanted. But I knew I wanted to be back in Dallas. And I was like, this is the only shop that's giving me an offer that's not mergers and acquisitions, that's finance. It's what I wanted to do. I had narrowed it down. And I was like, okay, fine. This is the only shop that's giving me an offer to do pure finance work. This is what I want to learn. This is what I want to get trained in. And I remember feeling like it was a bit of a risk. And now looking back, I see how much better of a position I am in my career as a mentor at Kirkland, as someone who, I closed a $3 billion deal on Tuesday. And I remember being like, oh, you did that alone. That's kind of wild. And like, you don't know, but all those deals are the same. You can be doing a $10 million deal or a $10 billion deal. And the pieces, all of the pieces of the puzzle are the exact same. And that's where I think there's a bit of a fallacy in the prestige that people focus on in law school, because you don't have to have that incredible prestige to really learn the mechanics and learn how to put the puzzle together. Once you have that down, you can apply those skills anywhere to the biggest deals you can think of. And that's what's important. So I think that really trying to focus in on training and the people and whether or not people care about making you a good attorney is what's more important.
Be sure to check out our previous episodes on corporate law, international law, IP law, as well as our episode featuring our president and VP, Hania and Zara. Please also follow us on Instagram and LinkedIn at UTDWPL. As always, this is Under Oath, and I rest my case.
Thank you for tuning in today to our bi-weekly episodes. My name is Maisha Shaif, and I'm the production chair for WPL. This episode was written by Nadia Bhatti, edited by Kara Curtis, and hosted by Kavya Venugopalan. If you enjoyed this episode, I would appreciate it if you left a short review on whatever platform you're listening on. Also, follow us on Instagram at UTDWPL and LinkedIn at UTD Woman Pursuing Law. Goodbye and stay safe.